CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. Today, Professor Joshua Mostow of the Department of Asian Studies, a specialist in Japanese culture and fine arts, and co-author of a catalog relating to a new show soon to open at the Royal Ontario Museum. He's also a new fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Welcome to the show, Joshua.
Thank you, Ira.
Well, let's begin with Japan. How did you become interested in the people and the language and the culture?
Lots of different causes being raised in the 60s and 70s in Southern California, where there were actually Japanese students. Their families had moved over, people like general managers of Hitachi or companies like that. You may have heard of the 60s and 70s.
I vaguely recall, Joshua.
Eastern religion, martial arts, all those sort of things were very much in the air, and of course Japan was part of that. So for a variety of causes, that's where I turned my interest.
So right from the beginning of, say, an undergraduate career, you became interested in studying Japanese, and or was it something that evolved?
Well, it actually started in high school. Actually, it started in junior high school with reading Isherwood's translation of the Bhagavad Gita, the famous Hindu text. And I remained interested in Hinduism and Buddhism throughout high school. Was fortunate enough to hook up with a professor at one of the local Cal States who kind of directed me. So that when I graduated from high school, I wanted to get right to work. I thought I was going to study Buddhism. I figured I was going to need the four canonical languages of Chinese, Japanese, Tibetan, and Sanskrit. UCLA had intensive Chinese or intensive Japanese. I knew Japanese people. I had Japanese friends. I didn't have any Chinese friends. So that's where I started.
Fascinating. When was the first time you went to Japan?
I would have been my second year of undergraduate. So that after high school, I did the summer intensive. I did a year at Penn, and then the second year I was at the International Christian University in Tokyo.
Do you remember your impressions? What did it match your expectations or not?
I think I'm fairly lucky in terms of my personality. I don't often have expectations. I just kind of wait and see what happens. So I did not have really intense preconceptions of what I was going to experience, which was probably just as well.
Okay. And then over the years, of course, I know you've gone back many times. You've lived there for some periods of time, right?
Sure. Dissertation research, sabbatical for a couple years. I go every year at least once. I think if you wrapped it all together, probably I've lived there 8 years.
Mm-hmm. And do you find it's changed dramatically? I mean, a lot can happen in a 25-year period.
Yes. Well, and I very much wish I had 25 years ago been taking pictures of what I was seeing, because what I was seeing is now entirely gone. Not to get necessarily nostalgic about it. I mean, it was not necessarily very attractive or artistic or anything like that, but it was different. And, of course, with the bubble economy and the big boom, things just entire neighborhoods were kind of razed to the ground and rebuilt, something like we experienced in Vancouver. Yes, it's undergone a lot of change. And also, of course, demographically, in universities and whatnot, they're facing a lot of challenges.
Absolutely. Now, I know you're particularly interested in connections between like text and image in mm-hmm. Japanese culture. So I want you to answer this question really directly. Are you a frustrated painter?
No, I'm not. I may be a frustrated art critic, I know I don't have the eye-hand coordination for painting, and I don't, you know, if I were frustrated at anything, it would be a frustrated musician. I got started on this line of work when I thought I was still something of a poet, and I found myself writing poems about paintings. And that got me interested in the inter-arts comparison.
This, of course, in terms of contemporary culture, goes back quite a long way. I'm thinking of Pound and Pound's essay on the Chinese written character and his great attraction to the pictorial dimension of Chinese poetry. So do you feel that there's this constant interplay between text and image in the literature?
Well, certainly not the way Pound understood it. China and Japan do have a kind of ut pictura poesis tradition. I'm actually preparing for a conference that's going to be happening at the end of the month in Emory called Ut Pictura Amor. And so I'm kind of going back and looking at my picture poem theory stuff in China and Europe as well. And, just came back on a little book by Michael Sullivan where he starts saying, we're going to try to answer the question that everyone who's interested in Chinese art has to ask at some point, why do they write on their pictures? Why do they write on their paintings? So obviously calligraphy plays a much larger role in the East Asian tradition than it does in early modern and forward Europe. And that has to have some effect on the literary art as well.
I would think so, and on the literary art of both American and, European writers, mm-hmm. And on artists do text but then kind of have in some sort of pictorial dimension with the text or vice versa.
Right.
They do the painting, then they add text mm-hmm. to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think do you believe that there are like connections that cross these, the popular term, transnational elements, or do you think it's an effort on the part of, say, the Western writer or painter to incorporate the East?
I think it's an aim. I think it's an idea or a goal that becomes attractive at certain times, at certain places, and people look for antecedents. There's a kind of fundamental semiology to the text-image relationship, and that historically gets activated in certain ways. But I wouldn't put it at a kind of universal aesthetic or something like that. I wouldn't go that far.
Okay. Now, tell us something about this upcoming exhibit. You've contributed to the catalog in the Royal Ontario Museum. What is it going to be about, and how does it reflect perhaps some of your broader interests with Japan?
Yeah, not actually one of the text image projects, but first of all, the ROM has not had a major Japanese show for about two decades. It hasn't had a Japanese curator since the last person died tragically about 25 years ago. And so it's really a kind of hidden gem. And it turns out that they have a pretty substantial collection of Japanese woodblock prints, ukiyo-e. And in particular, they're particularly strong on 18th century. And that includes, most prominently, the artist Harunobu. And a number of years ago, I co-edited a book with Norman Bryson on gender and power in the Japanese visual field. And my contribution was looking, it'd be a long story to tell how I got to that text, but a text from about the 1670s that exists only in one copy, which is in fact the first homosexual pornographic text in Japan. It's really not proper to talk about homosexuality per se in early modern Japan, you have a personage, I guess is what I'm going to call him at the moment, who is essentially an adolescent young man. And he's called a wakashu. And he is attractive to both older men and to women of all sorts, young women his own age and older women. And so you have kind of what are seen as two paths of love, nyodo, woman love. And of course, the subject is always the adult man. So he can be interested in women, or he can be interested in young men. And they're kind of created textually in the period. There's a discourse on it. They play little mock battles, debates, which is better, that sort of thing. Anyway, so that's kind of a substrate in the Japan's early modern period, that there are what I'm arguing is a distinctive gender of these wakashu, these young men. And they are distinguished by the kind of clothes they wear, how their hair is cut. They have four locks, and behind the four locks, the top of the head is shaved. And in visual representations of them, almost always, it's very easy to tell when it's a wakashu, despite the fact that his clothing might look very much like a young woman's with long sleeves and flowery robes and da-da-da-da-da. You'll always see that little shave spot. Almost always. And there are three periods in the early modern epoch where there's confusion.
Okay, I just want to interrupt you for 1 second. Are these images fairly prevalent?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so they appear and reappear and reappear in these 18th century prints.
Yeah, well, they start in the 17th century and they go to the early 19th century. So it's just what's portrayed. Harunobu is one of those three periods where there's real gender ambiguity, where suddenly the previously very clear markers are erased and you don't know really what you're looking at. So the show tries to do two things. First, it tries to say, look, this is really quite easy. I know you look at this figure and say, I can't tell whether it's a boy or a girl. Well, we're going to show you how to tell. See, and there's that little shave spot here, and there it is there, and that's all fine. And then, of course, we have to complicate it and say, well, you know, it's not quite that simple. And there are times when you really can't tell, and here's what's happening there. And that also involves the use of what are called onnagata, so specialists of female roles on stage, because women are banned from the stage in about 1629.
How many items will be exhibited?
Almost 100. It was originally supposed to be a much smaller show, and we managed to make the ROM curatorial staff interested, and so now it's a B-level show with a much larger budget and a catalog.
Excellent. Now, just tell me, how does one go about organizing a museum exhibition?
Well, you would have to talk to the curator, Asato Ikeda, who got her PhD here at UBC a few years ago. It sounds like it's fairly frustrating. But, you know, I mean, one of the things is that museums work on both a longer time frame and a shorter time frame than academics do. And so the show has to be scheduled far in advance, but then somehow the catalog is always being done, it seems, at the last moment. So the dynamics of that and various levels of consulting, you know, the ROM has had a marked history of problematic shows. So there's a lot of community consultation going on and stuff like that. So it's rather complicated.
Will there be many borrowed items in this show?
No, it's almost entirely from the ROMSO collection.
Well, that's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's an eye-opener, so to speak.
Yeah. No, I have been really surprised at just how rich and deep the collection is.
What are your current interests right now? I mean, you described this show, but what else are you working on?
My current project is something I'm calling Popular Literary Literacy in Early Modern Japan. So literacy in Japan has fascinated foreigners since, you know, the Portuguese first came. It seemed like everyone could read. Recently there's a scholar who has been talking about popular literacy. So farmers and more marginal groups. And I'm interested in not just literacy, but literary literacy. How the general public or the urban masses understood their classical literary tradition. And there's one work that is kind of the foundation of this. It's a collection of poems called the 100 poems, one poem each, which is what my first book was on, actually. And with the boom of print capitalism in the 17th century, you get illustrated versions of it with little commentaries. You get polychrome woodblock prints. You get collections of anecdotes. You get a whole level of popular discourse that is relatively distinct from kind of the scholarly discourse. And that's what I'm kind of interested in.
So genre does seem to play a role in this, doesn't it?
Sure.
And maybe dissolving genre into other more accessible forms?
Cross-pollination, I guess, would be, you know, the way to think about it. There are new genre that start in the early modern period, but they are always alluding back to earlier classical forms.
So I want to more or less end with a fairly naive question. If someone is really fascinated by Japanese culture, what would be the first steps in studying it or learning to understand it? That is to say, would you begin with the language? Would you study the history? Would you turn to the art? How would you outline a program for someone who's listening to us and says, you know, I'm kind of fascinated by Japan. Where do I begin?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we kind of have an embarrassment of riches now in English. You could pick virtually any topic and find good scholarly, but also, you know, kind of popular introductions to it, whether it's martial arts or games playing or kimono or cuisine or whatever. And I think getting all that information in English first creates a framework and starts giving you some of the vocabulary and the concepts that would make it much easier if you then choose to actually go in and learn the language or learn the language specific to that. I have a co-author of a book we did, a woodblock print book. He's a biochemist or something. He was at the University of Utrecht, and he's a specialist in actor prints of a certain period of time. And he doesn't really read or speak Japanese, but he can recognize artist signatures. He can recognize seals. He can read enough of this very specialized material to be actually able to work with it. So,
I think that's a fascinating example. It gives me hope. It's been a real delight. Thanks to Professor Joshua Mosto of the Asian Studies Department for stopping by. And stay tuned for further conversations with the exciting faculty and students of the Faculty of Arts at UBC. Thanks again, Joshua.
Thank you, Ara.
Hi, I'm John K. Sampson from The Weaker Thans, and you are listening to